This tape is the second part of the first one.
Actually, the scholars who allege that Muhammad, may the peace and blessings of Allah be upon him, was the author of the Quran, claim something which is humanly impossible. Could any person of the 6th century of the Common Era utter such scientific truths as the Quran contains? Could he describe the evolution of the embryo within the uterus so accurately as we find it in modern science? Secondly, is it logical to believe that Muhammad, may the peace and blessings of Allah be upon him, up to the age of 40 was marked only for his honesty and integrity, began all of a sudden the authorship of a book matchless in literary merit and the equivalent of which the whole legion of the Arab poets and orators, the highest caliber, could not produce? And lastly, is it justified to say that Muhammad, may the peace and blessings of Allah be upon him, who was known as Al-Amin, the trustworthy, in his own society, and who is still admired by the non-Muslim scholars for his honesty and integrity, came forth with a false claim, and on that falsehood could train thousands of men of character, integrity and honesty, who are able to establish the best human society on the surface of the earth? Surely any sincere and unbiased searcher of truth will come to believe that the Quran is the revealed word of Allah. Without necessarily agreeing with all that they said, we furnish here some opinions of important non-Muslim scholars about the Quran. Readers can easily see how the modern world is coming closer to reality regarding the Quran. We appeal to all open-minded scholars to study the Quran in the light of the aforementioned truths. We are sure that any such attempt will convince the reader that the Quran could never be written by any human being. However, often we turn to it, the Quran, at first, even if it disgusts us the first time, it soon attracts, astounds, and in the end enforces our reverence. Its style, in accordance with its contents and aim, is stern, grand, terrible, ever and anon, truly sublime. Thus this book will go on exercising through all ages a most potent influence. This is by Goethe, quoted in T.P. Hughes' Dictionary of Islam, page 526. The Quran admittedly occupies an important position among the great religious books of the world. Though the youngest of the epoch-making works belonging to this class of literature, it yields to hardly any in the wonderful effect which it has produced on large masses of men. It has created an all but new phase of human thought and a fresh type of character. It first transformed a number of heterogeneous desert tribes of the Arabian Peninsula into a nation of heroes, and then proceeded to create the vast politico-religious organizations of the Mohammedan world, which are one of the great forces with which Europe and the East have to reckon today. This is by G. Magaliath, Introduction to J.M. Rodwell's The Quran, New York, Everyman's Library, published in 1977, page 7. A work, then, which calls forth so powerful and seemingly incompatible emotions, even in the distant reader, distant as to time and still more so as mental development. A work which not only conquers the repugnance which he may begin its perusal, but changes this adverse feeling into astonishment and admiration. Such a work must be a wonderful production of the human mind indeed, and a problem of the highest interest to every thoughtful observer of the destinies of mankind. This is by Dr. Stengas, quoted in T.P. Hughes' Dictionary of Islam, pages 526 and 7. The above observation makes the hypothesis advanced by those who see Muhammad as the author of the Quran untenable. How could a man, from being illiterate, become the most important author in terms of literary merits in the whole of Arabic literature? How could he then produce truths of a scientific nature that no other human being could possibly have developed at that time? And all this without once making the slightest error in his pronouncement on the subject? This is written by Maurice Bucaille in The Bible, the Quran and Science, published in 1978, page 125. Here, therefore, its merits as a literary production should perhaps not be measured by some preconceived maxims of subjective and aesthetic taste, but by the effects which it produced in Muhammad's contemporaries and fellow countrymen. It spoke so powerfully and convincingly to the hearts of his hearers as to wield hitherto centrifugal and antagonistic instruments into one compact and well-organized body, animated by ideas far beyond those which have until now ruled the Arabian mind. Then its eloquence was perfect, simply because it created a civilized nation out of savage tribes, and shot a fresh and shed a fresh proof into the old warp of history. This is Dr. Steingast, quoted in Hughes' Dictionary of Islam, page 528. In making the present attempt to improve on the performance of my predecessors and to produce something which might be accepted as echoing, however faintly, the sublime rhetoric of the Arabic Quran, I have been at pains to study the intricate and richly varied rhythms which, apart from the message itself, constitute the Quran's undeniable claim to rank amongst the greatest literary masterpieces of mankind. This very characteristic feature, that inimitable symphony, as the believing Pickett Hall described his holy book, the very sounds of which move men to tears and ecstasy, has been almost totally ignored by previous translators. It is therefore not surprising that what they have wrought sounds dull and flat, indeed, in comparison with the splendidly decorated original. This is A.J. Arbery in The Quran Interpreted, published in London by the Oxford University Press in 1964, page 10. A totally objective examination of the Quran in the light of modern knowledge leads us to recognize the agreement between the two. As has already been noted on repeated occasions, it makes us deem it quite unthinkable for a man of Muhammad's time to have been the author of such statements, on account of the state of knowledge in his day. Such considerations are part of what gives the Quranic revelation its unique place, and forces the impartial scientist to admit his inability to provide an explanation which calls solely upon materialistic reasoning. This is by Maurice Boucaille in The Quran and Modern Science, published 1981, page 18. The moral system of Islam. Islam has laid down some universal fundamental rights for humanity as a whole, which are to be observed and respected under all circumstances. To achieve these rights, Islam provides not only legal safeguards, but also a very effective moral system. Thus, whatever leads to the welfare of the individual or the society is morally good in Islam, and whatever is injurious is morally bad. Islam attaches so much importance to the love of God and love of man that it warns against too much of formalism. We read in the Quran, "It is not righteousness that you turn your faces towards east or west, but it is righteousness to believe in God and the last day, and the angels, and the book, and the messengers, to spend of your substance out of love for him, for your kin, for orphans, for the needy, for the wayfarer, for those who ask, and for the ransom of slaves, to be steadfast in prayers and practice regular charity, to fulfill the contracts which you have made, and to be firm and patient in pain or suffering and adversity, and throughout all periods of panic. Such are the people of truth, the God-fearing." This is from the Holy Quran, chapter 2, verse 177. We are given a beautiful description of the righteous and God-fearing men in these verses. Man should obey salutary regulations, but he should fix his gaze on the love of God and the love of his fellow men. We are given four heads. 1. Our faith should be true and sincere. 2. We must be prepared to show it in deeds of charity to our fellow men. 3. We must be good citizens, supporting social organizations. And 4. Our own individual soul must be firm and unshaken in all circumstances. This is the standard by which a particular mode of conduct is judged and classified as good or bad. This standard of judgment provides the nucleus around which the whole moral conduct should revolve. Before laying down any moral injunctions, Islam seeks to firmly implant in man's heart the conviction that his dealings are with God, who sees him at all times and in all places, that he may hide himself from the whole world, but not from God, that he may deceive everyone, but he cannot deceive God, that he can flee from the clutches of anyone else, but not from God. Thus, by setting God's pleasure as the objective of man's life, Islam has furnished the highest possible standard of morality. This is bound to provide limitless avenues for the moral evolution of humanity. By making divine revelation as a primary source of knowledge, it gives permanence and stability to the moral standards which afford reasonable scope for genuine adjustments, adaptations, and innovations, though not for perversions, wild variations, atomistic relativism, or moral fluidity. It provides a sanction to morality in the love and fear of God, which will impel man to obey the moral law, even without any external pressure. Through belief in God and the Day of Judgment, it furnishes a force which enables a person to adopt the moral conduct with earnestness and sincerity, with all the devotion of heart and soul. It does not, through a false sense of originality and innovation, provide any novel moral virtues, nor does it seek to minimize the importance of the well-known moral norms. Nor does it give exaggerated importance to some and neglect others without cause. It takes up all the commonly known moral virtues, and with a sense of balance and proportion, it assigns a suitable place and function to each one of them in the total scheme of life. It widens the scope of man's individual and collective life, his domestic associations, his civic conduct, and his activities in the political, economic, legal, educational, and social realms. It covers his life from home to society, from the dining table to the battlefield and peace conferences, literally from the cradle to the grave. In short, no sphere of life is exempt from the universal and comprehensive application of the moral principles of Islam. It makes morality reign supreme and ensures that the affairs of life, instead of being dominated by selfish desires and petty interests, should be regulated by the norms of morality. It stipulates for man a system of life which is based on all good and is free from all evil. It invokes the people not only to practice virtue, but also to establish virtue and eradicate vice, to bid good and to forbid wrong. It wants that the verdict of conscience should prevail, and virtue must not be subdued to play second fiddle to evil. Those who respond to this call are gathered together into community and given the name Muslims. And the singular object underlying the formation of this community, the Ummah, is that it should make an organized effort to establish and enforce goodness and suppress and eradicate evil. Here we furnish some basic moral teachings of Islam for the various aspects of a Muslim's life. They cover the broad spectrum of personal moral conduct of a Muslim as well as his social responsibilities. First is God consciousness. The Quran mentions it as the highest quality of a Muslim. The most honorable among you in the sight of God is the one who is most God conscious. It's from the Holy Quran, chapter 49, verse 13. Humility, modesty, control of passions and desires, truthfulness, integrity, patience, steadfastness, and fulfilling one's promises are moral values which are emphasized again and again in the Quran. We read in the Quran, "And God loves those who are firm and steadfast," in chapter 3, verse 146. "And vie one with another to attain to your sustainer's forgiveness and to a paradise as vast as the heavens and the earth, which awaits the God-conscious, who spend for charity in time of plenty and in time of hardship, and restrain their anger and pardon their fellow men, for God loves those who do good." Chapter 3, verses 133 and 134. "Establish regular prayer, enjoin what is just and forbid what is wrong, and bear patiently whatever may befall you. For this is true constancy. And do not swell your cheek with pride at men, nor walk in insolence on the earth. For God does not love any man proud and boastful. And be moderate in your pace, and lower your voice. For the harshest of sounds indeed is the braying of the ass." This is chapter 31, verses 18 and 19 of the Holy Quran. In a way which summarizes the moral behavior of a Muslim, the Prophet, may the blessings of peace of Allah be upon him, has said, "My sustainer has given me 9 commands: to remain conscious of God, whether in private or in public, to speak justly, whether angry or pleased, to show moderation, both when poor and when rich, to reunite friendship with those who have broken it off with me, to give to him who refuses me, that my silence should be occupied with thought, that my looking should be an admonition, and that I should command what is right." Social responsibilities. The teachings of Islam concerning social responsibilities are based on kindness and consideration of others. Since a broad injunction to be kind is likely to be ignored in specific situations, Islam lays emphasis on specific acts of kindness and defines the responsibilities and rights of various relationships. In a widening circle of relationship, then, our first obligation is to our immediate family, parents, husband or wife and children. Then to other relatives, neighbors, friends and acquaintances, orphans and widows, the needy of the community, our fellow Muslims, all our fellow human beings and animals. Parents. Respect and care for parents is very much stressed in Islamic teaching and is a very important part of a Muslim's expression of faith. Your sustainer has decreed that you worship none but him and that you be kind to parents, whether one or both of them attain old age in your lifetime. Do not say to them a word of contempt nor repel them, but address them in terms of honor, and out of kindness lower to them the wing of humility and say, My sustainer, bestow on them your mercies, even as they cherished me in childhood. This is chapter 17, verses 23 and 24 of the Holy Quran. To other relatives, and render to the relatives their due rights, as also to those in need and to the traveller, and do not squander your wealth in a manner of a spendthrift. This is chapter 17, verse 26. Regarding neighbours, the Prophet, may the peace and blessings of Allah be upon him, has said, He is not a believer who eats his fill when his neighbour beside him is hungry, and he does not believe whose neighbours are not safe from his injurious conduct. Actually, according to the Quran and Sunnah, a Muslim has to discharge his moral responsibility not only to his parents, relatives and neighbours, but to the entire mankind, animals and useful trees and plants. For example, hunting of birds and animals for the sake of game is not permitted. Similarly, cutting trees and plants which yield fruit is forbidden, unless there is a very pressing need for it. Thus, on the basic moral characteristics, Islam builds a higher system of morality by virtue of which mankind can realize its greatest potential. Islam purifies the soul from self-seeking egotism, tyranny, wantonness, and indiscipline. It creates God-fearing men, devoted to their ideals, possessed of piety, abstinence and discipline, and uncompromising with falsehood. It induces feelings of moral responsibility and fosters the capacity for self-control. Islam generates kindness, generosity, mercy, sympathy, peace, disinterested goodwill, scrupulous fairness, and truthfulness towards all creation in all situations. It nourishes noble qualities from which only good may be expected. Human rights in Islam. Since God is the absolute and the sole master of men in the universe, He is the sovereign Lord, the sustainer and nourisher, the merciful, whose mercy enshrines all beings. And since He has given each man human dignity and honor, and breathed into him of His own spirit, it follows that, united in Him and through Him, and apart from their other human attributes, men are substantially the same, and no tangible and actual distinction can be made among them on account of their accidental differences such as nationality, color, or race. Every human being is thereby related to all others, and all become one community or brotherhood in their honorable and pleasant servitude to the most compassionate Lord of the universe. In such a heavenly atmosphere, the Islamic confession of the oneness of God stands dominant and central, and necessarily entails the concept of oneness of humanity and the brotherhood of mankind. Although an Islamic state may be set up in any part of the earth, Islam does not seek to restrict human rights or privileges to the geographical limits of its own state. Islam has laid down some universal fundamental rights for humanity as a whole, which are to be observed and respected under all circumstances, whether such a person is resident within the territory of the Islamic state or outside it, whether he is at peace with the state or at war. The Quran very clearly states, O believers, be you securers of justice, witness for God. Let not detestation for a people move you not to be equitable. Be equitable, that is nearer to God-fearing. This is chapter 5, verse 8. Human blood is sacred in any case and cannot be spilled without justification. And if anyone violates the sanctity of human blood by killing a soul without justification, the Quran equates it to the killing of entire mankind. Whoso slays a soul not to retaliate for a soul slain, nor for corruption done in the land, could be as if he had slain mankind altogether. It is not permissible to oppress women, children, old people, the sick, or the wounded. Women's honor and chastity are to be respected under all circumstances. The hungry person must be fed, the naked clothed, and the wounded or diseased treated medically, irrespective of whether they belong to the Islamic community or are from amongst its enemies. When we speak of human rights in Islam, we really mean that these rights have been granted by God. They have not been granted by any king or by any legislative assembly. The rights granted by the kings or the legislative assemblies can also be withdrawn in the same manner in which they are conferred. The same is the case with the rights accepted and recognized by dictators. They can confer them when they please and withdraw them when they wish, and they can openly violate them when they like. But since in Islam, human rights have been conferred by God, no legislative assembly in the world or any government on earth has a right or the authority to make any amendment or change in the rights conferred by God. No one has the right to abrogate them or to withdraw them. Nor are they basic human rights which are conferred on paper for the sake of show and exhibition and denied in actual life when the show is over. Nor are they like philosophical concepts which have no sanctions behind them. The Charter and the proclamations and the resolutions of the United Nations cannot be compared with the rights sanctioned by God, because the former is not applicable on anybody, while the latter is applicable on every believer. They are a part and parcel of the Islamic faith. Every Muslim or administrator who claim themselves to be Muslims will have to accept, recognize, and enforce them. If they fail to enforce them and start denying the rights that have been guaranteed by God, or make amendments and changes in them, or practically violate them while paying lip service to them, the verdict of the Holy Quran for such governments is clear and unequivocal. Those who do not judge by what God has sent down are the disbelievers. Chapter 5, verse 44. The human rights in an Islamic state. 1. The security of life and property. In the address which the Prophet delivered on the occasion of the farewell Hajj, he said, "Your lives and properties are forbidden to one another till you meet your Lord on the day of resurrection." The Prophet has also said about the dhimmis, the non-Muslim citizens of a Muslim state, that one who kills a man under covenant, that is a dhimmi, will not even smell the fragrance of paradise. 2. The protection of honor. The Holy Quran lays down, A. You who believe, do not let one set of people make fun of another set. 2. Do not defame one another. 3. Do not insult by using nicknames. 4. Do not backbite or speak ill of one another. This is chapter 49, verses 11 and 12 of the Holy Quran. 3. Sanctity and security of private life. The Quran has laid down the injunction. A. Do not spy on one another. B. Do not enter any houses unless you are sure of their occupants' consent. 4. The security of personal freedom. Islam has laid down the principle that no citizen can be imprisoned unless his guilt has been proved in an open court. To arrest a man only on the basis of suspicion and to throw him into a prison without proper court proceedings and without providing him a reasonable opportunity to produce his defense is not permissible in Islam. 5. The right to protest against tyranny. Amongst the rights that Islam has conferred on human beings is the right to protest against government's tyranny. Referring to it, the Quran says, God does not love evil talk in public unless it is by someone who has been injured thereby. In Islam, as has been argued earlier, all power and authority belongs to God. And with man, there is only delegated power which becomes a trust. Everyone who becomes a recipient or a donee of such a power has to stand in awful reverence before his people, towards whom and for whose sake he will be called upon to use these powers. This was acknowledged by Abu Bakr Siddiq, who said in his very first address, "Cooperate with me when I am right, but correct me when I commit error. Obey me so long as I follow the commandments of Allah and His Prophet, but turn away from me when I deviate." 6. The freedom of expression. Islam gives the right of freedom of thought and expression to all citizens of the Islamic State on the condition that it should be used for the propagation of virtue and truth and not for spreading evil and wickedness. The Islamic concept of freedom of expression is much superior to the concept prevalent in the West. Under no circumstances would Islam allow evil and wickedness to be propagated. It also does not give anybody the right to use abusive or offensive language in the name of criticism. It was the practice of the Muslims to inquire from the Holy Prophet, may the blessings and peace of Allah be upon him, whether on a certain matter a divine injunction had been revealed to him. If he said that he had received no divine injunction, the Muslims freely expressed their opinion on the matter. 7. Freedom of association. Islam has also given people the right to freedom of association and formation of parties or organizations. This right is also subject to certain general rules. 8. Freedom of conscience and conviction. Islam has laid down the conjunction, there should be no coercion in the matter of faith. On the contrary, totalitarian societies totally deprive the individuals of their freedom. Indeed, this undue exaltation of the state authority, curiously enough, postulates a sort of servitude of slavishness on the part of man. At one time, by slavery was meant total control of man over man. Now that type of slavery has been legally abolished, but in its place, totalitarian societies impose a similar sort of control over individuals. 9. Protection of religious sentiments. Along with the freedom of conviction and freedom of conscience, Islam has given the right to the individual that his religious sentiments will be given due respect and nothing will be said or done which may encroach upon his right. 10. Protection from arbitrary imprisonment. Islam also recognizes the right of the individual that he will not be arrested or imprisoned for the offences of others. The Holy Quran has laid down this principle clearly. No bearer of burdens shall be made to bear the burden of another. 11. The right to basic necessities of life. Islam has recognized the right of the needy people that help and assistance will be provided to them, and in their wealth there is acknowledged right for the needy and the destitute. 12. Equality before the law. Islam gives its citizens a right to absolute and complete equality in the eyes of the law. 13. Rulers are not above the law. A woman belonging to a high and noble family was arrested in connection with theft. The case was brought to the Prophet, may the blessings of Allah be upon him, and it was recommended that she might be spared the punishment of theft. The Prophet, may the blessings of Allah be upon him, replied, "The nations that lived before you were destroyed by God, because they punish the common man for their offences, and that their dignitaries go unpunished for their crimes. I swear by him who holds my life in his hand, that even if Fatima, the daughter of Muhammad, had committed this crime, I would have amputated her hand." 14. The right to participate in the affair of states, and their business is conducted through consultation amongst themselves. This is chapter 42, verse 38 of the Holy Quran. The Shura, or the Legislative Assembly, has no other meaning except that the executive head of the government and the members of the Assembly should be elected by free and independent choice of the people. Lastly, it is to be made clear that Islam tries to achieve the above-mentioned human rights and many others not only by providing certain legal safeguards, but mainly by inviting mankind to transcend the lower level of animal life, to be able to go beyond the mere ties fostered by the kinship of blood, racial superiority, linguistic arrogance, and economic privileges. It invites mankind to move on to a plane of existence where, by reason of his inner excellence, man can realize the ideal of the brotherhood of man. Life after death. The question whether there is a life after death does not fall under the jurisdiction of science, as science is concerned only with classification and analysis of sense data. Moreover, man has been busy with scientific inquiries and research, in the modern sense of the term, only for the last few centuries, while he has been familiar with the concept of life after death since times immemorial. All the prophets of God called their people to worship God and to believe in life after death. They laid so much emphasis on the belief in life after death that even a slight doubt in it meant denying God and made all other beliefs meaningless. The very fact that all the prophets of God have dealt with this metaphysical question of life after death so confidently and so uniformly, the gap between their ages being thousands of years, goes to prove that the source of their knowledge of life after death, as proclaimed by them all, was the same, that is, divine revelation. We also know that these prophets of God were greatly opposed by their people, mainly on the issue of life after death, as their people thought it impossible. But in spite of opposition, the prophets won so many sincere followers. The question arises, what made those followers forsake the established beliefs, traditions, and customs of their forefathers, notwithstanding the risk of being totally alienated from their own community? The simple answer is, they made use of their faculties of mind and heart and realized the truth. Did they realize the truth through perceptual consciousness? Not so, as perceptual experience of life after death is impossible. Actually, God has given man, besides perceptual consciousness, rational, aesthetic, and moral consciousness too. It is this consciousness that guides man regarding realities that cannot be verified through sensory data. That is why all the prophets of God, while calling people to believe in God and life after death, appeal to the aesthetic, moral, and rational consciousness of man. For example, when the idolaters of Mecca denied even the possibility of life after death, the Quran exposed the weakness of their stand by advancing very logical and rational arguments in support of it. And he has coined for us a similitude, and has forgotten the fact of his creation, saying, "Who will revive these bones when they have rotted away?" Say, "He will revive them, who produced them, at the first, for he is the knower of every creation, who has appointed for you fire from the green tree, and behold, you kindle from it. Is not he who created the heavens and the earth able to create the like of them? Yes, and he is indeed the supreme creator, the all-knowing. This is chapter 36, verses 78 through 81. On another occasion, the Quran very clearly says that the disbelievers have no sound basis for their denial of life after death. It is based on pure conjecture. They say, there is nothing but our present life. We die and we live, and nothing but time destroys us. Of that they have no knowledge, they merely conjecture. And when our revelations are recited to them, their only argument is that they say, bring us our fathers, if you speak truly. This is chapter 45, verses 24 and 25. Surely God will raise all the dead, but God has his own plan of things. A day will come when the whole universe will be destroyed, and then again the dead will be resurrected to stand before God. That day will be the beginning of the life that will never end, and that day every person will be rewarded by God according to his or her good or evil deeds. The explanation that the Quran gives about the necessity of life after death is what moral consciousness of man demands. Actually, if there is no life after death, the very belief in God becomes irrelevant, or even if one believes in God, that would be an unjust and indifferent God. Having once created man not concerned with his fate, surely God is just. He will punish the tyrants whose crimes are beyond count. Having killed hundreds of innocent persons, created great corruptions in the society, enslaved numerous persons to serve their whims, etc. Man having a very short span of life in this world, and his physical world too, being not eternal, punishments or rewards equal to the evil or noble deeds of persons are not possible here. The Quran very emphatically states that the day of judgment must come, and God will decide about the fate of each soul according to his or her record of deeds. Those who disbelieve say, the hour will never come unto us. Say, nay, by my Lord, but it is coming unto you surely. He is the knower of the unseen. Not an atom's weight, or less than that, or greater, escapes him in the heavens or in the earth. But it is in a clear record, that he may reward those who believe and do good works. For them is pardon and a rich provision. But those who strive against our revelations, challenging us, theirs will be a painful doom of wrath. This is chapter 34, verses 3 through 5 of the Holy Quran. The day of resurrection will be the day when God's attributes of justice and mercy will be in full manifestation. God will shower his mercy on those who suffered for his sake in this worldly life, believing that an eternal bliss was awaiting them. But those who abused the bounties of God, caring nothing for the life to come, will be in the most miserable state. Drawing a comparison between them, the Quran says, is he then, to whom we have promised a goodly promise, the fulfillment of which he will meet, like the one to whom we have provided with the good things of this life? And then on the day of resurrection, he will be of those who will be brought arraigned before God. This is chapter 28, verse 61. The Quran also states that this worldly life is a preparation for the eternal life after death. But those who deny it become slaves of their passions and desires. They make fun of virtuous and God-conscious persons. Such persons realize their folly only at the time of their death, and wish to be given a further chance in the world, but in vain. Their miserable state at the time of death, and the horror of the day of judgment, and the eternal bliss guaranteed to the sincere believers, are very beautifully mentioned in the following verses of the Holy Quran. Until, when death comes unto one of them, he says, my Lord, send me back, that I may do right in that which I have left behind. But nay, it is but a word that he speaks, and behind them is a barrier until the day when they are raised. And when the trumpet is blown, there will be no kinship amongst them that day, nor will they ask of one another. Then those whose scales are heavy, they are successful, and those whose scales are light are those who lose their souls in hell abiding. The fire burns their faces, and they are glum therein. This is chapter 23, verses 99 through 104. The belief in life after death not only guarantees success in the hereafter, but also makes this world full of peace and happiness by making individuals most responsible and dutiful in their activities. Think of the people of Arabia. Gambling, wine, tribal feuds, plundering and murdering were their main traits when they had no belief in life after death. But as soon as they accepted the belief in the one God and life after death, they became the most disciplined nation of the world. They gave up their vices, helped each other in hours of need, and settled all their disputes on the basis of justice and equality. Similarly, the denial of life after death has its consequences not only in the hereafter, but also in this world. When a nation as a whole denies it, all kinds of evils and corruption become rampant in that society, and ultimately it is destroyed. The Quran mentions a terrible end of Ad, Thamud, and the Pharaoh in some detail. The tribes of Thamud and Ad disbelieved in the judgment to come. As for Thamud, they were destroyed by the lightning, and as for Ad, they were destroyed by a fierce roaring wind, which he imposed on them for 7 long nights and 8 long days, so that you might see the people laid prostrate in it, as if they were the stumps of fallen down palm trees. Now do you see remnants of them? Pharaoh likewise, and those before him, and the subverted cities. They committed errors and they rebelled against the messengers of their Lord, and he seized them with a surpassing grip. Lo, when the waters rose, we bore you in the running ship, that we might make it a reminder for you, and for heeding ears to hold. So when the trumpet is blown with a single blast, and the earth and the mountains are lifted up and crushed with a single blow, then on that day the terror shall come to pass, and the heavens shall be split, for upon that day it shall be very frail. Then as for him who is given his book in his right hand, he shall say, Here, take and read my book. Certainly I thought that I should encounter my reckoning. So he shall be in a pleasing life in a lofty garden, its clusters nigh together. Eat and drink with wholesome appetite, for that you did long ago, in the days gone by. But as for him who is given his book in his left hand, he shall say, Would that I had not been given my book, and not known my reckoning. Would it had been the end. My wealth has not availed me, my authority is gone from me. This is chapter 29, verses 4 through 39 of the Holy Quran. Thus, there are very convincing reasons to believe in life after death. In summary, firstly, all the prophets of God have called their people to believe in it. Secondly, whenever a human society is built on the basis of this belief, it has been the most ideal and peaceful society, free of social and moral evils. Thirdly, history bears witness that whenever this belief is rejected collectively by a group of people in spite of the repeated warnings of the prophet, the group as a whole has been punished by God, even in this world. Fourthly, the moral, aesthetic, and rational faculties of man endorse the possibility of life after death. Fifthly and finally, God's attributes of justice and mercy have no meaning if there is no life after death. For more detailed information on Islam, you can contact the World Assembly of Muslim Youth in headquarters in Riyadh, or a branch office at Jeddah. In Riyadh, it's Post Office Box 10845, Riyadh 11443, and the telephone number is 01-464-1669. For WAMI, that's World Assembly of Muslim Youth, in Jeddah, it's Post Office Box 8856, Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, and the telephone number is 02-689-1962.